Blog Talk Radio.
I am the nation. I was born on July 4th, 1776, and the Declaration of Independence is my birth certificate. The bloodlines of the world run in my veins because I offered freedom to the oppressed. I am many things and many people. I am the nation. I am 200 million living souls and the ghost of millions who have lived and died for me. I am Nathan Hale and Paul Revere. I stood at Lexington and fired the shot heard round the world. I'm Washington, Jefferson, Patrick Henry. I'm John Paul Jones, the Green Mountain Boys, and Davy Crockett. I'm Lee and Abe Lincoln. I remember the Alamo, the Maine, and Pearl Harbor. When freedom called, I answered and stayed until it was over there. I left my heroic dead in Flanders fields and in the steaming jungles of Vietnam. I am the Brooklyn Bridge, the wheatlands of Kansas, and the granite hills of Vermont. I am the coal fields of the Virginias and Pennsylvania, the fertile lands of the West, the Golden Gate and Grand Canyon. I sprawl from the Atlantic to the Pacific. 3 million square miles. I'm more than 3 million farms. I'm forest, field, mountain, and desert. I'm quiet villages, and I'm cities that never sleep. You can look at me and see Ben Franklin walking down the streets of Philadelphia. I'm Babe Ruth in the World Series. I'm 130,000 schools and colleges and 326,000 churches where my people worship God as they please. I'm a ballot dropped in a box. I am an editorial in a newspaper. And I'm a letter to a congressman. I'm Thomas Edison, Albert Einstein. I'm Horace Greeley, Will Rogers, and the Wright brothers. I'm George Washington Carver, Daniel Webster, and Jonas Salk. I'm Walt Whitman, Thomas Paine, Tom Sawyer, and Walt Disney. Yes, I am the nation, and these are the things that I am. I was conceived in freedom, and God willing, in freedom I'll spend the rest of my days. May I possess always the integrity, the courage, and the strength to keep myself unshackled, to remain a citadel of freedom and a beacon of hope to the entire world. I am the nation.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Patriot Education. My name is Terry Rowland. I'm your hostess for this evening. And as always, we are brought to you through the good offices of www.patriotfamilies.com. A great group of people who do understand that we are the nation, and being the nation makes us one large extended family. Our topic this evening, ladies and gentlemen, is Super Teacher and the Bureaucratic Kryptonite Explosion. But before we get into that, I would like to ask all of you listening out there and my friends in the chat room to say a prayer for our friend Ron Golden, host of Constitution Hour, who lost his father yesterday. We send our prayers and our thoughts and many hugs to Ron and his family in this difficult time. We remember Tom with joy and happiness, and we know that he is at home. To get to our topic for this evening, ladies and gentlemen, I work with a great many super teachers. Now, they don't wear their cape to school every day, at least not so you can see it, but they really do take on the role of a superhero. Our federal government, through the kindly intervention of Jimmy Carter's Department of Education, has pretty much required of them that they assume superpowers. The teacher in the classroom, ladies and gentlemen, has gone from being an instructor and helper in the learning process of children to being a surrogate parent, grandparent, psychologist, counselor, nurse, political advisor, babysitter, and general dog's body to the administration of whatever school he or she works in. In order to achieve this kind of superhero set of powers, our teachers put in about 12 to 14 hours per day during the week, and another 5 or 6 on each of the weekend days. There are a great many folks out there who believe, erroneously, that being a teacher is, quote-unquote, easy work. This myth has haunted the teaching profession for over 100 years now, and one would think it would be time to chase it away or at least shed some light on it. Teachers, ladies and gentlemen, not only stand in front of a classroom and dole out worksheets, explain problems, go over concepts, answer questions, etc., they also have to grade papers, they have to fill out paperwork for government-required individualized education programs, Title I, 401, Form 501. There are at least 20 pieces of paper that follow every student in each one of the 5 to 6 classroom periods they have every day. They have to record grades, they have to grade papers, they have to plan their lessons, not according to their experience and their knowledge and their passion, but according to guidelines set up for them by governmental bureaucrats who have never stood in front of a classroom in their lives. Unless, of course, they were hauled in front and put a dunce cap on their head when they were very small, if they're old enough to remember dunce caps. Super teacher is being inundated with more and more and more of the bureaucratic kryptonite that has created a nightmare in our public schools. I had to work 3 days this week in preparation for getting school started next week. Now, that's not a complaint. That was just a requirement. Part of my job as a paraprofessional in the school system where I work is to assist teachers when the students are not there on the preliminary days before school starts, on teacher work days, on days when the students are not there to make copies, shelve books, move furniture, whatever it is a teacher or an administrator might request us to do. So I see what goes on and what those teachers have to put up with. I see their frustration when they are given a classroom of 25 children and told that they must individually educate each one of them. I see them struggle with ways to put forth, quote-unquote, interactive learning in that size classroom where the students are basically guiding their own learning and the teacher is a facilitator. Well, this sounds really, really nice, ladies and gentlemen, and I'm sure there are lots of parents out there who are just tickled pink about it because they have no clue what it actually means. This is one large box of kryptonite that our teachers are now being forced to adopt along with the common core standards and methodologies. The idea behind this is that children should, in effect, guide their own learning based on an inquiry method, meaning the teacher gives them something or other, and then they are to ask questions about it and answer questions about it and so on and so forth, either in small groups or individually, and organize the information and find key points with the teacher basically just walking around saying, okay, look for this key point, etc. Well, for one thing, the small group collaborative business is counterproductive when you're dealing with middle school students, and not very effective when you're dealing with high school students, and totally impossible when you're dealing with elementary school students. My friend Doc had a question that a teacher that he talked to, who teaches French, that she has 4 class periods and 1 prep period, and her time in front of students is 4 hours a day, and she makes $80,000 a year and works 9 months a year. Well, Doc, I think she made it sound a lot better than it is. I have taught foreign language classes, as well as been an ISS supervisor. That teacher's 4 hours in front of the children, okay, is only one-third of her day. All programs, curricular items, grading, specific accommodations, etc., have to be done on her own time, because there is not time in one prep hour to do all of the paperwork, all of the grading, all of the computer work, and all of the lesson planning that is needed. I have substituted in just about every subject in all three middle school grades, including PE, band, chorus, and art, as well as the core subjects and foreign languages. If the teacher has to be absent, that teacher has to prepare lesson plans well in advance so that the substitute can find them and the children don't fall behind. Those lesson plans have to be prepared ahead of time, and there is no time during the working day to do it. If you count the rest of the duties that the teachers have, Doc, in addition to just standing in front of the classroom, that teacher probably has lunchroom or cafeteria duty, probably has meetings each day with the department heads, or at least twice a week. There are staff meetings. There is professional development where they have to be introduced to new computer programs or new applications, new textbooks, new teaching manuals, new procedures, etc. Most teachers at the grade level that I work, this is middle school now, this is 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, there are 6 class periods during the day. Most of the core teachers have 4 periods, 4 class periods. The additional 2 periods are shorter. The class periods are approximately 55 minutes to an hour. The school day is approximately 7.5 hours long, roughly. So the other part of that day, if you take that 4 hours from the 7.5, an hour and a half out of the 3 is elective time for the students, and that's the planning time for the core teachers. That's what they have if they're lucky. That is not just for planning. That's also when department meetings are scheduled, sessions with the principal or the guidance office regarding individual students, phone calls home to parents, writing letters, etc. That has to be done in that time. The other hour and a half is basically meetings. It's also if the teacher is lucky and she doesn't have to do cafeteria duty or a fill-in for a teacher who's absent, that's also when she or he can get something to eat. Also, people assume, like Doc does, that when you work 9 months a year, that's all you have to do. You don't do anything at all during the summer. That's not the case. During the summer, most teachers do 4 to 8 weeks of professional development or continuing education in order to keep their teaching certificate, their license to teach, up to date. So they are working basically 11 months out of the year. And yes, they get a month off. And that month off is the only time that they have to actually put down the textbook and put aside the Valium and maybe get a little time to relax. Now, the people in my county do not make that kind of money. And I know you're not criticizing her, as Doc, believe me, I do. But not everybody gets the kind of benefits and the kind of salary that are paid in some of our states, primarily because the cost of living and the unions do not have as much control in right-to-work states like the one in which I live. Now, I am not a big fan of unionizing government workers, ladies and gentlemen, purely and simply because the union movement in its inception in the 19th century was desperately needed because people were being exploited. A huge change from agricultural rural economies to industrial economies meant that many men who were heads of families and the only breadwinner lost their ability to earn a living because children and women were paid less to do the kinds of jobs that tended the machines and the mechanical contrivances that replaced those men's skilled labor. That trend, that reduction in labor cost by hiring those who did not need to be skilled, completely disrupted the concept of what was owed from employer to employee and from employee to employer. The familial aspect of worker and management that used to exist disappeared when the industrial age began. People began to be viewed as merely another form of machine, because machinery was much more efficient than a human being. You didn't have to feed it. It didn't get sick. It didn't want time off. It kept going no matter what you did, no matter what the weather was like. It didn't want to stop and talk. It was easier to control. And my friend Doc mentions that in Michigan, all kids have to take a foreign language. So the teacher who teaches French that he was talking about earlier gets a bunch of delinquents who really don't want to be there. And that's pretty much the case everywhere. The good side in the school where I work, the introduction to foreign languages in the 6th and 7th grade are fairly lightweight courses. The 8th graders, if their SOL scores, standards of learning scores, are high enough in English and language arts, can take a 4-credit high school Spanish 1 class or French 1 class that gives them advanced credits before going on to 9th grade. But unfortunately, many of them have absolutely no interest in learning anything. They just think that they're going to sit there and play with their iPad and write notes to each other and sleep, and they'll get credits for high school without actually having to do any work. And I know this from personal experience because I had to substitute in that class for about 5 weeks last year. Teachers have an incredibly difficult job. And unless you have been in the classroom in a position other than behind a student desk, it's difficult to understand exactly what your responsibilities must be when you teach. First of all, if you've ever had anything to do with children in groups greater than 5 or 6, you know that they are not very disciplined. Children have very, very little self-discipline. They are children. Self-discipline is learned and taught and gets better as we get older. We expect self-discipline from adults. Generally, we do not expect it from children. That means that the teacher is responsible not only for giving these children concepts, ideas, information, etc., but for trying to keep order enough so that all of them can at least hear what he or she is saying. You add into that that in today's classrooms, especially collaborative classes, the 60-40 holy percentage of 60% average or above and 40% special ed means that in their classroom, 4 out of every 10 children have great difficulties learning in traditional classroom settings. They have process difficulties. They have reading problems. They have attention problems. They have behavioral problems. And yet they are to be taught exactly the same material in the same amount of time as the 6 out of every 10 who are of average ability or above and do not have these specific difficulties. That means, in addition to trying to keep order, the teacher has to try to present the material at a pace and in a way so that all 10 out of 10 understand and follow what is being taught or discussed. Sometimes, generally in collaborative classes, the general education teacher has one or more special education teachers and or paraprofessional aides, student aides, teacher aides in the classroom who assist those 4 out of the 10 who have difficulties by doing all various things for them, organizing their notebook, writing things down for them if they're dysgraphic, keeping them quiet and distracted so that they do not interrupt the teacher, making sure that if they begin to get frustrated and get ready to throw furniture, that they're removed from the classroom so that the rest of the class doesn't get hit by a flying chair. These classes are very, very interesting, and I have worked in them. Okay, so that's one box of kryptonite. The idea that we can, as teachers, as educators, magically teach children with widely varying degrees of ability the same amount of material in the same amount of time for the entire 9 months of the school year, so that all of those children will achieve an average that allows them to pass their core classes sufficiently well that they can go on to the next grade level and go through it again. And if the 4 out of 10 do not pass, the teacher is reprimanded, called upon the carpet, and told that she needs to give them extra chores to bring their grades up so they too can pass with their peers, because their self-esteem will be damaged if they are held back. Then you get the next box of kryptonite, which is the epidemic of political correctness. A teacher must teach the material presented in the textbooks approved by the State Department of Education. That means that throughout the state, the same textbooks, okay, pretty much, are used. These textbooks are not chosen by the teachers. Generally, they are chosen by a combination of the administrators of the various schools, the members of the State Department of Education, and the educational theorists who work for the textbook companies and sell the particular books to the state and local officials who are going to buy them. The type of textbook and the actual edition or material in it is not chosen by the teacher. So that means when new textbooks come out, you have to spend the summer, if you're a teacher, if you can get a hold of the books, if they've actually gotten them before the next school year, you've got to go through them and read them and see what the read the teacher's edition and what the various activities are and which ones you're going to plan to use and which ones your classes may or may not do. And many of these textbooks now are requiring that good old child-centered, interactive, inquiry-based learning in the classroom business, that somehow or other the children guide themselves through the field of academia, and the teacher is just there to pat them on the back and nudge them in the right direction every once in a while. Two of my favorite teachers, both good friends of mine, were agonizing over how to put in place this interactive inquiry-based learning method that they've been told they have to inaugurate in classrooms with 20 to 28 sixth graders who have been spoon-fed and teacher-led through 5 years of school, how to get them to learn on their own with minimal teaching and lots of personal inquiry, exploration, and collaborative group learning. Well, I've been in education, private and public now, for about 40 years. And I have a good bit of experience with what children can and cannot do. I have grandchildren. I have no children of my own. I have grandchildren because I was fortunate enough to marry a man with three daughters. And they each have been fruitful and produced two kids. So I have six grandkids. So I'm aware of the abilities of children. The abilities of children to organize themselves, work as a committee or group, and still learn anything and pay attention are minimal. Have you ever watched a group of kids trying to do a collaborative project? My friend Bill says he'd be surprised if kids don't follow me around. Well, he's right, they do. I have no idea why, but they do. But have you ever watched a group of kids, like getting together to build a sandcastle or to put together a Lego thing or the old Lincoln Logs? There'll always be one kid who knows better how to do it than everybody else, and he or she is going to boss everybody else around. And they're all going to get angry because they don't want to be bossed around because each and every one of them is sure they know how to do it better than she or he does. There's always going to be one kid who has absolute fumble fingers and couldn't put together a ball in a cup without dropping both of them at least five times. And there's always going to be one kid who isn't interested in building the Lego thing, but he's having a great time pushing everybody else into the pile of blocks so they all fall down and he can laugh uproariously. Now, this is child-centered classroom, ladies and gentlemen, in microcosm. This is what teachers are supposed to institute. It's possible, barely possible, with kids of 15, 16, 17, 18, and a little bit more likely in study groups in college. But it is almost impossible with children under the age of 15. So when we look at our teachers, imagine, if you will, a classroom of four or five groups of children who are building a Lego construction, and the teacher is supposed to be directing and moderating all of those groups and get the construction finished in 55 minutes. Now tell me how easy it is to be a teacher. I don't classroom teach as a profession, ladies and gentlemen. I do classroom teach as a substitute, and when I sub, I teach. I do not hand out crossword puzzles or play a video unless the teacher has requested or put out a lesson plan for that. I teach. It is not my choice of profession. I have been asked many times if I wouldn't be interested in going back to school or at least getting a provisional license so I could teach full-time classroom, and I have politely said no, thank you. My forte, my experience, my expertise is in small group and individual learning and teaching. That I do well. That I enjoy. And I believe that is my way of making a difference. And that is what I do with the students who wind up in my in-school suspension classroom. And it is a sad commentary, ladies and gentlemen, that the vast majority of them tell me, you know, Ms. Rowland, I really don't like ISS, but boy, I sure learned a lot, got a lot done while I was in here with you. Yes, it's flattering. Yes, it makes me feel good that I've given them something. But it saddens me deeply to think they are not getting that in their regular classrooms, because I know their teachers, and their teachers are dedicated professionals who are passionate about teaching and learning. They themselves are lifelong learners. But the kryptonite in which they are mired is preventing them from doing the job that is their livelihood as well as their passion. Nobody asks teachers, ladies and gentlemen. Everybody just listens to bureaucrats and quote-unquote educational experts, most of whom have master's or PhDs in education and have avoided classrooms from the time they graduated with a bachelor's degree. We could change these things. As my friend Linda says, my style class is the only chance they actually have to see what learning entails, and it is that. But the problem we have in trying to institute a lot of these programs, like inquiry-based learning and small group work and so on and so forth, which are not bad in and of themselves, they are excellent pedagogical methodologies. They really are. And yes, kids enjoy them and they learn more with hands-on. The more of your senses you apply to any learning experience, the more likely you are to remember the material you are being taught. This has been known for 70 years. But you cannot do it in a classroom with 25 children for 55 minutes a day. You cannot put in place these methods, which work magnificently in lab schools attended by the children of university professors, or in private schools where class size is 12 to 14 maximum. It cannot be done. And we are losing teachers so fast, ladies and gentlemen, because we are asking the impossible of them. And I am not in any way saying that there are no bad teachers in the public schools. There are. As in any profession, from medicine to business to theology to education to politics, there are always people whose only interest is themselves and their own advancement or power. There are bad teachers. There are people who go into the profession because they love the power it confers, or because they think it's easy and they figure out ways to make it easy for themselves. But they are the minority, and most of them wind up being union representatives and quitting teaching and rising in the teachers' unions, ladies and gentlemen. And I hate to say this, but unfortunately it's true. Because, as I mentioned earlier, the original purpose of the union movement has been lost in the corridors of power. Unions across the board, other than craft unions, have become nothing more nor less than political clubs, both the kind you hit someone with and the kind you join to make yourself more important. Teachers' unions wield the power of money. They spend their members' dues to elect people who will give the teachers' union more and more and more power. And power corrupts. And absolute power corrupts absolutely. We have a crisis in our public education, ladies and gentlemen. This crisis has been going on for approximately 25 to 30 years because of a lot of different factors. The bureaucratic kryptonite that pretty much destroys Super Teacher is only one factor in the decline of American public education. Changes in the way we earn our living, changes in family structure, changes in community structure, changes in technology and communication, changes in mobility, in the sense of you don't stay in the same community from birth till death, and your children don't stay there either. Two-parent families where both parents work are more common than two-parent families where one is the breadwinner and the other is the homemaker. Marriages end in divorce much more frequently now than they did 35 or 40 years ago. A misguided attempt to equalize the socioeconomic position of the fighters for civil rights has created an entire class of professional victims. Women who become pregnant multiple times because that's how they get the money to live and enjoy the things that they enjoy, whatever those might be. Role models for our children used to be athletes, soldiers, statesmen, historical figures, poets, writers, inventors. Now, there are people, as my friend Linda mentions, like Miley Cyrus and her twerking performance at the Video Music Awards. These are the kinds of things, ladies and gentlemen, these breakdowns of what was an ordered society have their effects across the board. But the biggest effect, and the most dangerous, is the effect that it has on our children and their ability to be educated into functioning, educated, knowledgeable adult voters. Yes, I said voters. Because we still have a representative republic. But we are seeing the dreams of our founders being destroyed daily. They understood that the only way a nation constituted as we are could succeed was if the people, the individuals who elect our leaders, were aware and educated and willing and able to continue learning throughout their lives. They were such men. They understood that education, learning, getting knowledge and putting it in your head and keeping it there was what would give this nation its best chance. And they were right. It did. Our schools, our access to education for all children, built a world power, ladies and gentlemen. You just take a look at the kind of education the greatest generation, the men and women who fought and died and supported at home during the Second World War. Look at the education and the opportunity to learn that they had. I look at my own father, who was born in 1925, graduated from high school, could not afford to go to college, went to work as a draftsman at an aircraft corporation in St. Louis, took every course that was offered through his job, went to work on lent to another aircraft corporation in New York to do war work, and learn from the young men and women, the engineers who were working there, not only their engineering knowledge, but their social knowledge as well, and put that in his head, and then came back and continued to learn after getting married at 21 and having me celebrating his and my mother's first anniversary. He continued to learn, ladies and gentlemen, and rose to the point where he was an assistant project engineer, even though he had no degree and no actual college experience. But he had a working mind, and his basic education encouraged him to use it. And he, in turn, encouraged me and my sisters to use ours. He sent me to college because he knew I wanted to go, because I loved the idea of learning. And it cost him a great deal of money that he could ill afford. And when, as a college graduate working, I wanted to repay him for what he had spent, his response was, "No, I won't take it. That is my duty as your father." And I was glad to do it. That greatest generation to which he belonged was the product of an educational system that understood that the opportunity to learn was what public school was supposed to be about. Not about guaranteed wealth from the best job in the world because you went to college. Not about football scholarships. Not about self-esteem. Not about everybody gets a trophy, but about the chance to learn. With textbooks that you didn't have to try to buy when your parents were struggling through the Great Depression. My mother, and also born in 1925, she was raised from the age of 10 by a single mother who had only a sixth grade education. That my grandmother's sixth grade education was roughly the equivalent of 12th grade in today's schools. My grandmother loved poetry, and she loved to read. And she worked as a housekeeper, in a cafeteria, in a bakery, anything she could find to pay the fees to send both of her daughters through 12 years of parochial school. And both of them graduated. There was no way that either of them could have gone to college, although my aunt would have loved to. She was a gifted writer and a very bright lady. She went to work, married, and was childless. My mother went to work, married, and became a full-time homemaker. And she and my aunt both taught me and my sisters that what we needed to do was to follow our own path, to take advantage of every opportunity to educate ourselves. And if we didn't want to be a homemaker, that was fine. We should be the very best us we could be. Because that is what she, my mother, and my aunt learned from their mother and from their parochial schooling. Granted, they didn't go to public school. Their education was tougher and stiffer because they got Catholicism thrown in. But both my parents understood that education was an opportunity, and they understood that teachers weren't magic. Our homework was looked over. We were encouraged to ask questions of our parents if we ran into a problem with any of our homework assignments. We played games as a family that taught us things about numbers and about reading. We were being educated at home as well as at school. And part of our education at home was that we were expected to behave ourselves in a civilized fashion when we went to school. And that nobody owed us a good grade simply because we were there. And that nobody owed us success. We had to earn it. It was those philosophies of education, if you wish, ladies and gentlemen, that created that greatest generation, that basically saved the world from an incredibly dangerous and evil tyranny. And that generation wanted their children to live in a world where such tyranny would not have the opportunity to grow. They understood that the valor and the courage and the willingness to give your all for the benefit of others was the brightest part of being an individual. And that being an individual unique and important to oneself was the light, the spark that created this nation and gave it the power to stand up against evil. My friend Lonnie in the chat room says that's the magic word. Family cared. And they wanted us to be civil and gave us the opportunity to succeed. And that is exactly correct. The nuclear family was the seedbed. It still is. The students who succeed are backed and encouraged and taught by their family. And it doesn't have to be the traditional family, ladies and gentlemen. Don't get me wrong. I see my stepdaughter, a single mother, being that kind of family for two of my grandsons. But that's the key. Public education is being used as a laboratory to create the Borg collective, ladies and gentlemen. And I know that sounds like wild fantasy and there's a Star Trekkie, making up all this stuff, but I'm not making it up. This is the end product. Perhaps without the mechanical implants to the degree of the Borg, although that is coming too. But so far, the mechanical implants are only to replace non-functioning or amputated flesh portions of the body. But knowing the progressive thinking pattern, and understanding the progressive version of utopia, I have no doubt that so long as they could be, each and every one of them, the chief Borg, they would gladly turn the rest of us into members of the collective. For those of you who were not Star Trek Next Generation fans, and even for those of you who were, I'd like to recall an episode of that show in which a member of the Borg Collective, was captured by the crew of the Enterprise and repaired, if you will, and cut off from the collective, and learned to use the word I. Doesn't sound revolutionary, but for Hugh, the Borg character, it was. Because the collective does not think of I. The collective thinks of we. Listen to the politicians and the pundits, ladies and gentlemen. Listen to how they use we. And think about it. Listen to how they use I. And think about it. If I am speaking of something on this show that worries or concerns me or that has given me hope or that suggests a danger coming, I am going to say, I believe, not we believe, because I don't speak for anyone except myself. If I talk about procedures or activities in which I engage with others who follow the same profession I do, then I will use we. But I am very, very careful about how I use these extremely significant pronouns. I do not speak for all teachers, ladies and gentlemen. I can't. Because we who are in the educational profession are not a collective. We are a bunch of individuals, each of whom has abilities and skills and passions and interests that are unique. And if each of us is good at what we do, is that individuality, that personal approach to teaching and learning, that will captivate the children in our class? Perhaps not all of them. Perhaps many of them will not mesh with the personality or the passion of the teacher for his or her subject. But some will. I believe that if a teacher is passionate about his or her subject, passionate about learning and teaching, and interested in the receptivity and understanding of his or her students, that the children in that teacher's classroom will learn. And it is in this respect only, ladies and gentlemen, that I believe we can have super teachers. I'd like to say goodnight to my friend Yo. She's tired out, leaving the chat room for tonight. She's been having really, really bad headaches lately, everybody. So let's send some healing energy in the direction of our beloved Yolanda. I ask you, ladies and gentlemen, to think about what makes Super Teacher and to think about the kind of kryptonite that is going to deprive your children of a fantastic experience in Super Teacher's classroom. Because that kryptonite is not just harming Super Teacher, ladies and gentlemen, it's harming your kids. It is denying them an opportunity that you pay for, you support public education in this nation, ladies and gentlemen. It is your tax money that pays my salary and that of every other teacher administrator, HR professional, custodian, librarian in public schools. The public schools, like this nation, belong to you. They belong to the state or the federal government. They belong to you. Because it is your hard work that supports them and your children who reap the benefits or suffer the consequences of the type of education the public system provides. We need to all be aware that we must take part in our educational system. And we must encourage everyone that we know who has children in school to find out exactly what is happening in their classrooms and to pay attention to what they are teaching their kids at home. Because no matter how super teacher they are lucky enough to be taught by, they have to put forth the effort to learn at the same time. Because a teacher, even super teacher, cannot learn for you, no matter what age you are. Our job as parents, grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins, neighbors, friends, community leaders, business persons, our job is to teach our children that learning requires effort and it has to be done by the individual. There are no magic wands in our public schools or our private schools. We can't plug you into a recharging station in the collective spaceship and fill your head with the knowledge you need. If we can educate ourselves, ladies and gentlemen, and be seen to do so by our children, we will give them what they need to get the most out of our educational system, no matter how screwed up it gets. Because if you teach your child to be a lifelong learner, even school can't stop him or her. So long as he or she can read and wants to know, there is nothing standing in their way. But you have to inculcate that. You as parent, grandparent, aunt, uncle, cousin, business person, neighbor, whoever you are, if you interact with children, they have to learn from you, and not only by precept, but by your modeling it. You have got to show them that learning in and of itself is both fun and important. And one of the things that I hear most often from students is the crazy question, well, why do I have to learn this? I'm never going to use it. They're not hearing this in school, ladies and gentlemen. They're hearing this at home. If you've ever said, I don't need to know that to your child, shame on you, because you have just told them that some knowledge is worth something and some knowledge isn't. All knowledge is worth something, because if you try, children can't differentiate, ladies and gentlemen. They don't know the difference between fact and opinion. Half of them haven't even figured it out by the time they get to high school. And part of the reason they don't know the difference is because we have too many people out there implying as well as stating, oh, well, that's not important because it doesn't have anything to do with me. the ones who, oh, I never vote because they're all crooks anyway. Well, I don't pay any attention to politics. Or, no, I don't know who my senator is. He's just a crook anyway. My friend Rod says, when kids are taught they don't have to compete, try harder, and graduate, when they can't read or write good English, they create a third world child. And that is quite true. When we are so concerned with our children's self-esteem and feeling good about themselves and being popular and having friends and totally ill-equipped to earn a living, we are creating our very own banana republic. The number of kids who can't hold a job has skyrocketed over the past 30 years. The old joke about living in your mom's basement and all the complaints of, well, I just can't find a job. You probably could. You're just not going to find one that's going to pay you $50,000 to start fresh out of college. This is the expectation they have been given. They have been led to believe that feel-good, watered-down education where everybody passes and everybody gets a trophy is going to guarantee them, if they just make it through college, that somebody's going to hire them and pay them 50 grand a year to start, which is nonsense. The number of people who have majored in women's studies, for God's sake, who are sitting around their mother's bathrooms applying makeup to go on job interviews for 10 or 12 years because what they've learned is a total lack of use in any acceptable profession, except possibly prostitution, and the job hazards are pretty bad there. When we set our kids up for failure, which we do when we promise them that they can't fail, why are we surprised that they can't deal and they can't cope and they can't compete when tough times come up? Our kids need to learn, while they still have the protection of family behind them, that sometimes you do fail. And sometimes you don't work hard enough, and the consequences are that you don't get the prize that you wanted. And that nobody else is going to be able to learn for you. They need to learn and understand this when they are still children. Not when they're 25 and incapable of holding a job at McDonald's because they can't figure out why the boss gets angry and fires them when they don't show up for work for a week because they didn't feel good about their best friend breaking up with her boyfriend. And yes, I have had people who worked for me be indignant at losing their job for that reason, or something very similar to it. Super teacher does still live, ladies and gentlemen. There are a lot of super teachers out there. I know a great many of them. I am incredibly lucky and incredibly privileged to work with a whole bunch of super teachers on a day-to-day basis. Men and women who give their all so that their students can learn. And I see their frustration. I feel their frustration. And it makes me angry and upset and sad. Because, like any grandparent, I want the best for my grandchildren. I want them to have whatever success in life they choose to seek. But I also know that that success will have to come from their own effort. That nobody is going to walk up someday and hand them the keys to paradise just because they happen to be standing there at the right time, or they're wearing the right clothes, or they got the best haircut, or they're wearing $300 sneakers. I am not an indulgent grandmother. I'm not an indulgent person to my students either. I am, I hope, helpful. I am, I hope, dedicated to their acquiring knowledge. And I am, I hope, influential enough to give them something that will be of benefit to them long after I am gone. Super teacher doesn't have crowds applauding as he or she spreads his cape or her cape and flies over the classroom. Super teacher doesn't have a cartoon or a comic book or a movie made about them. There have been some, but generally they've not grossed much at the box office. Super teacher, quite often, doesn't know what effect he or she has had on the children that pass through his or her hands. Sometimes super teacher is lucky, and 20 years after having a child in a classroom, that child will bump into them or come by and say, "You know something? I learned from you. I remember what you taught me." And that makes it all worthwhile. There's no instant gratification in teaching, ladies and gentlemen. There's gratification when we see the light turn on and we see a concept all of a sudden come clear. But it's far from instant. There's no easy button in teaching. No matter how many people say, "Oh, well, you only work 9 months a year and you make all this money. It's an easy job." It may appear easy from the outside, but I can tell you from personal experience, it is not. My dear husband used to tell me that it was a darn good thing that I was the one who was working in education, because if he tried it, he'd wind up in jail. It takes an incredible amount of patience, ladies and gentlemen, and an incredible amount of emotional strength and fortitude and self-control to teach. And I get tired and I get frustrated, and some days I am holding on by the tips of my fingernails by the time I get home. But I keep doing what I do because I am driven to. This is what I do. And I certainly don't do it to get rich. I don't do it for public recognition. Mostly the recognition is, "Lousy teacher, my kid failed." I don't do it for power. I haven't got any power, and the only power I ever wanted was power over myself anyway. I do it because I am in love with the idea of learning, and I hope by my efforts to create a love affair with learning in the minds and hearts of the children I work with. And I know that I may not be able to do that for all of them. I may not even be able to do that for any of them. But the hope that I can is what keeps me doing the job that I do. And if you talk to any teacher, any super teacher, and there are lots of them, I'll bet you anything you would like to name that they will say the same thing. We don't do this job, ladies and gentlemen, because it's easy. We don't do it because we are going to become rich. We don't do it because we're going to become famous. How many of you out there even know who Teacher of the Year was in your child's school? Or if you don't have children, you don't even pay any attention to the fact that there is a Teacher of the Year. But I'll bet every single one of you listening out there has a memory of at least one teacher who made a positive difference in your life. And not necessarily because you may never have the chance to do that. You might not be able to say thank you. The teacher may never get one of his or her students come by and say thank you. But quite often, the teacher does get that. I have. And that, more than anything else, ladies and gentlemen, makes me feel proud. If we can build this nation, create a place where everyone has a chance to prove him or herself based on the content of character, then we can clean up and reform sensibly and productively the mess that public education has devolved into. But it will take all of us, ladies and gentlemen, to stand up for what we believe, to speak out, to say, wait a minute, that doesn't sound right to me. To ask why. To ask who is doing this. What is the purpose? How does this work? And not to let ourselves be intimidated or bullied or told we couldn't possibly understand because we aren't teachers. Yes, you can understand. Because you can think about what you've learned in your life. And think about the fact that you do not know what is going to come to you in your lifetime, ladies and gentlemen. Especially in a world that is changing so rapidly as ours. And you can let your children see that being a lifelong learner, being willing and eager to add to your knowledge, is what will keep you going and help you in difficult times. Because I know those of you out there listening have understood this and realized this. And we have got to remember that we are the nation, ladies and gentlemen. We need to remember the words from the Declaration of Independence and not just the part that everybody quotes about all men are created equal and inalienable rights, but the part that says governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed. You are the government. The people who make these rules, regulations, choose your textbooks, and decide what the standards are, they work for you. You put them in place with your vote. And if you don't pay attention, if you don't ask and demand that they explain to you what their goals are, and how exactly they plan to implement them before you push a button or poke a hole in a IBM style card or write something on a piece of paper to put that person in charge of your children's education, And that goes all the way from your county school board all the way up to the presidency and Congress, ladies and gentlemen. You are responsible for this government because you're the people who vote for it. And your children need to see you take that responsibility because it is how they learn. If we want our kids to become the kind of citizens who can govern themselves, we have to model the kind of individual liberty and individual responsibility that it takes to do that. Because precept alone does not teach. Children don't learn only by what we say to them, ladies and gentlemen. They learn by what we show them. In the way we live our lives, in the way we approach educating ourselves, in the way we pay attention to the issues of the day and the men and women who are deciding our fate. If we don't get involved in our public education, we will no longer have super teacher because the kryptonite will permeate every inch of the walls and floors and windows and doors of our schoolrooms. I want my grandchildren to be able to look back on one or two or three or six or however many teachers who gave them something important. As I can look back on the ones who did for me. I want for them that same understanding that it was worth it. That it was worth it. Now it's about time for the end of the show tonight, folks. It looks like we had a little glitch there, and it's possible that you may have lost the connection for a minute or two. I have a cat on my computer table who just rolled over on my USB port, external port. So if you lost the sound or lost the connection, that's my fault. Well, actually, it's Monkey's fault. That's the cat's name. And I do apologize. But my kitties are typical cats. They have never gotten over the fact that they were once worshipped as gods. And they expect that worship to continue. And I'm a sucker, and I give it to them. So Tiptoe and Monkey are lounging on my computer desk because I do my show tonight. And I guess maybe one of the reasons I went into education is because I'm kind of used to herding cats. And bowing to the royalty, as my friend Lynn says. But I do want to thank you for being here tonight, folks. And I believe in this country and the people who make up this nation. I believe that they are stronger than the politicians and the politically correct mouths that constantly harp on, no, there's no bad behavior, only communication we don't understand, and everybody's alike, and everybody should have equal stuff, and all of that stuff. No. I have faith in the people of this nation, because the climate of this nation has always been about liberty, and about responsibility, and about opportunity. And I do not believe any group of politicians can kill that spirit, ladies and gentlemen. Dictators and politicos and fanatical leaders have tried over and over and over again in the history of mankind to remake humanity into the Borg collective, and none of them has succeeded. And I do not believe that they will be able to succeed now. Because, as I said, I have faith in the human spirit. And I believe that this nation of ours is the best climate to create a resurgence of that human spirit. That desire to know and be everything that is possible by one's own efforts, by strength, by courage, by responsibility, by caritas, charity based from the heart, by caring about the future of our children and grandchildren, and caring about the present and the land we live in. I am an eternal optimist. When you work with kids, you have to be. My glass is always half full. Some days it verges on half empty, but I pull myself back up again and I see it as half full. And I believe that we can make the glass completely full, ladies and gentlemen, because we have the ability and we have the desire. And as I've said before, we are all teachers. Every single one of us. We teach by example anyone with whom we come in contact. We model, or should, the kind of person we would wish to be. And if we do that, others will see that, especially the young, and want to be just like you when they grow up. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is what makes a super teacher. And as I said, I believe that every single one of you in the chat room and out there listening is a super teacher, and I don't think there's enough kryptonite on the planet to stop you once you put that cape on and launch yourself into the air. And I believe that if we have super teachers, we certainly are going to have super students who will grow up to continue learning and to teach those that come after them. They say that the oldest profession will never completely disappear. And that's quite true. It won't. Because people will sell whatever they need to sell in order to live. And everybody looks for pleasure in life. But the second oldest profession, teaching, will also continue, ladies and gentlemen, because it is how we have advanced to where we are now. We are a learning species, and we will continue to be. Not because government will mold us into something, but because we are endowed with that human spirit by our Creator. And if we are created in the image of that Creator, then we are creators too. We are makers and doers and builders and thinkers and learners. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is what we need to rely on in these difficult times. Because it always comes down in the end to the individual. It has been individuals who have made the leaps that have allowed our species to advance as far as we have. It takes an individual to light the spark, and more individuals to feed the flame. I believe that if we put forth the effort, we can teach this and we can make our public schools into the type of educational environment that our children will remember with great gratitude. I know we can do it. Because I have faith in that human spirit and the climate of this nation which allows it to bloom. Thank you so much for being here tonight, ladies and gentlemen. I ask you to visit our website, www.patriotfamilies.com, where you'll meet some super teachers and some super students. And unfortunately, not my cats. They don't blog, at least not yet. And of course, Monkey seems to want to use her tail on my keyboard, but doesn't really come out right. So until they get ready to add a blog, it'll be just us human folks and human spirit that you'll see on patriotfamilies.com. But I do invite you to come and visit us, and I do invite you to join us here next week at 6 p.m. for Patriot Education. Call in. Join us in the chat room. Tell us what you think about the state of education and what you see can be done. Tell us what you think that's positive about the way things have changed. If you see something positive, there have been positive things. And one of these nights, I'll talk about those. I thank you all so much for your questions in the chat room. And, Doc, I'm so glad you enjoyed it. I was glad, I'm also glad that you got here at the beginning of the show tonight. And I appreciate your question. I was glad to have the chance to address it. Have a wonderful evening, everyone. And as I said, join us next week for Patriot Education at 6 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time here on Blog Talk Radio. Remember our friend Ron and his family in your prayers tonight, ladies and gentlemen. They've suffered a loss, and they need all the comfort and strength that you and God can give them. And as always, my dearest love to my greatest fan. Good night, everybody, and blessed be.
Blog Talk Radio and Patriot Family is where you need to be if you want to be informed and inspired 5 days a week. On Monday at 7:30 p.m., you can listen to the Constitution Hour. On Tuesday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Patriot Family Chat. On Wednesday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Right from the Left Coast. On Thursday at 6 p.m., you can listen to Patriot Education. And on Friday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Exposed but Never Forgotten. All times are Eastern Standard Time. Hope to see you there.